previously.tvpodcastnetwork.
Oh my God! Oh my God! Oh, don't touch it. Please don't touch it.
Investigation Discovery miniseries Dead North brings us the worst barbecue ever, and ITV miniseries Dark Angel brings us the worst cup of tea ever. Hope you packed a lunch, by which I mean I hope you didn't let anyone else touch it. It's The Blotter Presents, episode 57. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to The Blotter Presents, previously.tv's take on all things TV true crime. I am joined once again by recent unsolved mystery solved mystery and my husband, Dan Patrick Brady. Hi, Dan.
Hello, America.
I still have the little clip of you yelling about acetone. Would you like to hear it?
Sure.
All right. Hold, please. Update. I just love doing that. All right, here we go.
As Brown pulled away in his truck, police closed in.
Come on, hands to the roof. Move fast. Come on, feet back, way back.
He told us that the acetone belonged to another subject.
Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant.
Yes, I have no complaints. Listeners may have some complaints as they were assured after last week that they were never going to hear about this topic again. I lied.
I was hoping never hear about it either. So there we go.
Reader, he married it. Okay, let's get into our actual, most wanted section. Today we are discussing a two-night, four-part miniseries from Investigation Discovery called Dead North, which I think I don't exactly understand the title. Like, it sort of made that perfect generic Investigation Discovery title sense, and then I was like, but is Dead North a thing people say? Versus True North? Like, maybe they should have called it Untrue North. Anyway, let me read the case file, which is taken from a somewhat edited version of Investigation Discovery's PR materials, to wit. When Laura Frizzo, the lone female police chief in the isolated, relentlessly cold world of Michigan's Upper Peninsula, began an investigation to find missing person Chris Regan, she never expected to uncover an alleged female serial killer as well. Dead North leads Frizzo down a rabbit hole that alludes to cannibalism, reveals human remains, and uncovers a deadly love triangle. Through extensive body cam footage and interrogation room conversations, this exclusive docuseries chronicles every firsthand detail of this bizarre Fargo-like tale. So I watched all four. We got screeners for all four, which was very nice of the network. And I watched all four. I wasn't sure what to expect. And the storytelling, I thought was rather sedately paced, but good. I thought that it sort of unfolded at a, I don't know what the word is, like a amiable pace. It wasn't talking down to viewers, but it also wasn't like brushing past stuff. You were seeing the same footage of Regan in a sailboat over and over again, but I thought it was pretty good. Dan?
I will totally agree with you. I don't think it pretty much had me hooked from the beginning. I think they did a great job with that clip that you just played, because that begins the series. And you only get the payoff about what it's talking about at the very end. So you are sort of enthralled by that, and you want to keep going for that. And this, it could have been shorter. They probably could have done the episode. They could have told the whole story and told it well in three or maybe even two episodes. But it wasn't the normal kind of rushed, kind of half-assed, kind of slapsticky stuff that happens with the reenactments and with these shows. It was done, well done. You got a real good sense of who these people were, and I appreciate that.
Yeah, it did give you good texture. I agree.
And you really began rooting for the police chief. So, and they stayed away from. I mean, to me, this was the last season of Fargo in so many ways, and they stayed away from that completely. Not in terms of the theme of that Fargo, but in terms of there being a woman police chief trying to get a job done and getting basically sidetracked by male idiots above her.
Yeah,
and they
true.
Stayed away from that. They didn't do any of that Fargo stuff. You knew that world was out there, and this sort of made you feel that world just by the environment. But they certainly did not hammer you over the head with it.
I don't think they were condescending about the fact that it was a small town, and that the Upper Peninsula does share certain things in common with, I would say, Alaska in terms of some of the people that are attracted to living there, that it does attract people who want to go off the grid and maybe, you know, are allergic to cities sort of psychologically. And I also liked that she was very ready to call state police, to call the FBI and just be like, look, I'm one person. Like, we have a detective that we have to borrow from like down the street. And so you're going to have to send me some help. There are some things that once you've watched enough crime shows, it seems fairly obvious that, for example, the woman, the ex-girlfriend who reported Chris Regan missing, is probably not a suspect just because she reported him missing and let detectives into his apartment. But I also appreciated that they just sort of took you through that, and that they had interviews with Terry, the ex-girlfriend, just talking about how she found that a little bit offensive. Here's clip two.
Terry didn't live far from the park and ride where Chris's vehicle was found. Chris and Terry had a romantic relationship that didn't work out. Did tell me that there was a time when she noticed these communications with other women on Chris's computer and confronted him about it. Chris, you know, liked other women, and they thought, you know, well, maybe Terry was jealous.
One night I was sitting at home and I hear this knocking at my door, and it's two police officers. They sat there for over 2 hours questioning me about Chris, and they kept saying, well, you know, maybe he killed himself, maybe he took off. And they implied that maybe I had something to do with it. And I kind of got enraged. I was upset about that.
This is one juncture at which I found myself thinking that this might have worked better as a podcast, because they do have somewhat chewy accents, but because it's the actual people, of course, they're not, you know, it's not like overplayed because they're themselves. But I kept thinking, which is something I often think now, especially when I'm listening to a Frontline instead of watching it, that there are a lot of these nonfiction crime shows that might be better suited to just an audio experience. Would you agree with that, or were you?
Well, I can certainly agree to it, because they only have limited visuals that they can show. That's why they keep repeating the same B-rolls and the same shots that they have of people who maybe have died. So you can see one picture again and again and again.
Yeah, I was like, if I have to see Chris Regan winching one more time, like, may he rest. I hope he's winching away in heaven, but geez.
Yeah.
Oh, but, spoiler, he's not just missing, I guess.
They found him.
Yeah.
I didn't think of it in terms of that, because I don't listen to nearly as many podcasts as you do, and obviously I don't do as many podcasts as you do. And so I'm not as familiar with that I mean, now that's a definitely an accepted form of storytelling. So that didn't occur to me, but I think that this illustrates, this illustrates one of the great things about the show. It took the time to go ahead and explore the, woman closest to the man, maybe she's the guilty party, and get that out of the way fairly quickly, but not too quickly.
Right.
You also got time to get to know who this, I really felt that they gave me time to get to know who this girlfriend was and why she came forth seeking to discover what happened to this guy. And by knowing her, I felt like I knew him better, you know, and they took the time to do this and they didn't sensationalize it at all. And then once it was over, it was gone, you know, and she actually, after this beginning period, was not in the series much anymore. And yet her presence was still there. So I just think that was really well done. I don't know if this provided an archetype of how one accomplishes what they accomplished. They just did that. They were able to do it.
Yeah, I liked that they sort of said, well, this is the normal investigative track that you go down, is that someone close to the victim who maybe had, you know, here are the possible motives, and you look close to the victim. And they dealt with her possible involvement. And then once that was done, they moved away from her in the story. But it was also good to start with her because you got a sense of him. You got a sense of the victim and why someone would be very intent, even though they were no longer romantically involved, on making sure that he was okay and tracking him down. So after they have dispensed with Terry in their investigation, they move on to his co-worker / trick, I guess, Kelly Cochran. Kelly Cochran is a married lady. She is married to Jason. And Jason has kind of a lot of problems and is real eager to tell you about them right up front during an interrogation in clip 3.
In advance, I see a therapist for high anxiety. Mm-hmm. I actually was institutionalized a little over a month ago where I get really flustered in that. So,
okay.
You know, I seem like I'm getting wound up. I do see a therapist for it, so.
And all of a sudden, he's just bawling. I'm thinking to myself, who starts an interview this way? You know? What does he have to be crying about at this moment? I mean, he's here because we want to know if he might have any idea where Chris Reagan might be. So to me right away, I thought, man, you know, this guy knows a lot more than what he's saying.
Yeah, he does. he also knows about more things than we find out here. We'll get to that in a little bit, but this is a section in which sort of the end of the first episode going into the beginning of the second one, I feel like they were spending a lot of time sort of going back and forth on differing versions of who, of what the respective spouse's understanding of their arrangement was.
Yeah, just to clarify, Jason and what's her name are married
to each other.
I can't remember her name. Yes, they're
Kelly.
Married, and then Jason and Kelly are married, and then she is seeing Chris, and she says Jason knows about it, and he confirms that he knows about it.
But then this was a little vague. Like, he was apparently in some accident that rendered him unable to work, and I think also rendered him unable to perform in the traditional sexual manner. So I think the story there was that she was like, well, now that your tackle is busted, you can let me have affairs or I'm getting a divorce. So instead of being like, you're an asshole, please check your wedding vows, he elected to let her have affairs, but then was very depressed and jealous about it, and may or may not have been abusive towards her. Let's hear clip 4.
Kelly would describe her husband as being unstable, as having some mental issues. Kelly would talk about how she got pushed down the stairs or was threatened or pushed up against the wall. When I found out that Chris had disappeared, I thought maybe Jason might have been involved with it.
Eric also warns Chief Frizzo that Kelly can't be trusted.
I knew that some people went so far to call her a liar. She would tell stories at other places that people weren't believing or they weren't adding up.
First of all, that is Eric Erickson, another one of Kelly's collegial boyfriends at various times. Second of all, listeners have noted that, Dan, you like to get in a side dig at the president every now and then. And I think this, I think Eric's very gentle distinction without a difference between lying and telling stories that aren't true gives you a perfect opportunity to do so.
Trump's a liar. I'll let it go at that.
Okay. There we go. I did feel they spent maybe a little bit too much time, given that they couldn't seem to, the show wasn't really taking a position on what might be true. And given where it ends up with Kelly, I felt like maybe we spent a little too much time kind of underlining that her version of events is unreliable and that she's a selfish manipulator. Like, I kind of feel like I know where this is going based on the press materials. Did you think that this was a bit slow in this section?
Well, I mean, not really. No, I mean, again, I think it was doing what it needed to do to tell the story the way it needed to be told. Because, again, most people check into this and they don't really read the press materials, you know? So
True, fair enough.
In depth. So I think that right now it's going through the standard thing of, where's Chris? Okay, he had a girlfriend. Well, it's not the ex-girlfriend always. He had a relationship with somebody else. Oh, she's married. That's weird. Let's look at her and the husband. And, oh, she's got another piece on the side. So let's look at him, too. And it's sort of taking through this process here. One thing that I really liked about this show, and this gets into it at this point in time, this becomes sort of a standard thing that they do. They have reenactments, but there's no dialogue in the reenactments. You see people going and standing and talking and stuff like that, but you don't see them actually actors trying to make up dialogue to push something along,
right?
Which is what they do to you. I mean, no one said, ask him about acetate. I was just going, well, I'm supposed to find out about acetate. I guess I'll yell acetate. and that's what most of these people do in these reenactments. They don't, you know, I don't think that they're that well scripted.
They're not intrusive.
No, but what they did show, which I was fascinated by, was they showed the actual interviews, police interviews, of all these different people. And so you got to watch Kelly being interviewed and Jason being interviewed and Eric being interviewed at the police station. And I found that to be really interesting because my actual first take of Jason was not the same as the sheriff. She was saying that, you know, she immediately assumed that he was very guilty of something, and I immediately assumed that he was just very browbeaten by his partner.
Yeah, and troubled, you know? As well, whether that was related or not. I did also like that, first of all, going into and out of ad breaks, they didn't, and this may be different in the aired version. As we record this, it's the first night. By the time you listen to this, all the episodes will have aired and it may be a little different, but they weren't like doing a ton of rehashing coming out of an ad break, which I appreciated. And they weren't doing a ton of tricksy cutting of the interviews either. Some of you who, if you weren't big fans of the Blair Witch Project, may find some of the body cam footage a little queasy making. I thought it was fine. And I thought it gave you a good sense of Chief Rizzo sort of, like in one example, they're serving a search warrant. And in another example, they've been separated and one of them has come downtown in her car and like her phone is ringing and she's just being a little bit awkward about the situation, which I guess in a town that small is rather awkward. So I liked that. That was different. You don't usually see it that unmediated.
Right. And you usually don't see the actual body cam footage. And they did a good job of showing that too, which mm-hmm. I thought was a great insight into actual solving of a case.
Yeah, I agree. Let us go back for a moment to the subject of the reenactments. You will see this in some of our visual aids, which you can find on social media. We're at Blotter Presents on both Facebook and Twitter. So eventually, after the various serving of the search warrants and Jason and Kelly sort of disappearing from town, they get around to interviewing the neighbors about a certain barbecue. And while the clip that you're about to hear is rolling, you see these reenactors blithely enjoying what they think are hamburgers. Listener, they were not ham. Clip 5.
Jason claimed he was a butcher back in Indiana who specialized in exotic meats.
Well, it was definitely something I never ate before. It was like a transparent kind of like meat, like a lobster or a shrimp. And it had the texture of it. Like, the soft firmness of it. It was like something I never had.
When we found out the guy was gone, we were always wondering about that. What if they were that kind of people and actually did kill a guy and then butchered him up and had us over for dinner? I believe we ate him.
I'm like, oh God, oh God, like, no. When I realized that I might have ate the dude, I didn't want to believe it.
I'm sorry.
This is Mr. Sailor. I think the guy in the interrogation segment is his uncle. And then I forget their first names, but this man's talking head interview rendition of, oh God, like, no. It's the best. I mean, I shouldn't make fun because he goes on to say that he's like, it changes you. And then he talks about how he's lost all this weight and he can't enjoy cookouts anymore because he may have eaten a Chris Regan burger. Oh my God. Like,
I can't keep down a brat now. I don't know.
I know.
It's hilarious.
It's like, what are you doing for Memorial Day? I'm staying indoors and eating frozen foods. Good day.
Good day, sir. Good day to you, sir.
Oh. When I figured out we maybe ate the dude.
Oh, man.
I know.
And he doesn't get excited. He's just deadpan the whole time. Oh, yeah, that was bad.
Yeah, and he does look, he's just wearing like a pullover fleece and like a, you know, giveaway snap cap and sort of looking at the camera like, the thing is, gross. And you're like, yeah. I mean, this isn't the most like delicately diplomatic way to state it, but yeah, your neighbors were like, hey, who never like really actively, I think they did hang out, but only to like smoke pot. And they're like, let's have an expensive barbecue.
Yeah, they said these guys don't have any money. And all of a sudden they've got all these, it looks like $200 worth of meat there.
Yeah.
You know, to eat.
Oh, God. Like, no. it does seem later in this episode, like perhaps this is not the first barbecue that Casa Cochran has used to dispose of an unwanted body. You called for clip 6. Let's give that a listen.
After doing the 2 search warrants and getting the horrible news from the lab that nothing had come back to indicate their involvement, I was very frustrated. And it just became apparent to me that this was going to be tough because these people have obviously done something like this before. They've obviously been rehearsed in how to cover things up.
I'm glad that you called for that clip, because it did feel to me as though the concept that they had done this before, and that Kelly in particular may have a string of bodies on her, which we're never going to find out because, spoiler, she poisoned Jason and he go. And she's currently in jail forever for the death of Chris Regan and the death of her husband, whom no doubt she killed because he was starting to, because she didn't trust him to keep his mouth shut. But we kind of went into this thinking like, okay, female serial killers, that's pretty unusual. And then they kind of don't really get into like that part of it until much closer to the end. Did you find that frustrating? Well, do you want to see like part two of this and see where they go with it? Not that she'll talk to them, but
I'd love to find out what the other stories are, because we never do. Spoilers, sorry about that. But they don't mention serial killer in the actual episodes until you get to the third one, when they actually bring up the word serial killer, and then they kind of drop that until you really get into the fourth one, when you suddenly, they begin to put everything completely together and realize she's, you know, her brother her brother comes in and says,
yes,
I think she's done this before. And then you suddenly go, oh my God. And he goes, yeah, they were at this place and this place and this place and this place. And then you find out that according to Kelly, which again, very, very, very dubious source. And I think she's spreading the guilt into her now dead husband, who couldn't possibly protect himself. But she says that they made a pact when they got married that if one of them fooled around, they had to kill the person they fooled around with. So,
right.
And they, on their wedding night, they made this pact.
Yeah.
So,
okay.
Yeah, we got a couple of people who are a little unhinged to begin with. But note that they never bring up the fact that he killed anybody who was his lover. It was always her and multitude lovers that she had.
Well, she definitely, I can definitely see, because I know this type. She's like kind of gothy and kind of wants you to be scared of her, and like always has the hennaed hair and the tattoo she did herself, and she's like a kind of a tryhard. So if I were Jason, I would have been like, okay, like, you know, whatever, Black Widow. And then once you're in it, it's like, oh, she's actually like this. And then we also hear these jailhouse calls that she makes to her mom, where I think her mom, who is also interviewed for the documentary and is, I believe, legit horrified that she raised this monster, is, I think, trying to get Kelly to admit anything on the call so that maybe she can expiate her own sense of guilt at having unleashed, you know, the Kelly Kraken on the states of Michigan, Tennessee, Indiana, et al. Because evidently this killing spree has crossed a number of states. But she's like, she's just talking to her mom about how she's always been like this, and she's gone to shrinks and she's read the, you know, DSM-4, and she just doesn't, like, there's no cure for what she is. She's just that way, and she always has been. And I thought that was like, I understand that unless Kelly admits to something or another state starts an investigation that will lead to her, there's really nothing that the filmmakers can do in terms of like exploring those leads. But I think this was well enough made. And I think the process that a small town police chief, who is mostly just trying to make sure everyone isn't drunk driving all over the place, has to confront this, you know, complicated a case that he or she isn't used to, and see where it leads. I mean, in this case, it leads to, like, she's clashing with the city manager who decides that he doesn't want no ovarian Americans running the cop shop in his town, and gets rid of her. And then when she follows the trail of the Cochrans to Indiana, she winds up, like, in a relationship with the investigator in Indiana. Ogden? Is that his name?
Yeah. Yeah.
We'll hear him in the last clip. But yeah, it was like, oh, well, that was very Fargo-y also, sort of. But I was like, oh, that actually happens. Hilarious.
He seemed like a nice guy, too. I felt very good for the both of them.
Yeah, we saw some pictures of them enjoying some, like, margaritas on Facebook. And I hope it all works out and she gets another job, or that they both move to Tennessee and we can have, like, dead South. And we could figure out what happened.
And then the West Coast. And
yeah. Dead West. Yeah. This could go
Northwest.
Yeah. But she, in our last clip, we will hear Kelly being like, yeah, it was, I just let them think that I was more involved than I was because I felt bad. But she clearly doesn't feel bad. And Ogden is having none of her bullshit in clip 7.
There would have been circumstantial evidence that they could have used against me. But I gave them everything they needed. It was just easier to make everybody believe that I had more to do with it than I did, because in my heart I felt guilty because Chris isn't here.
No, it's Kelly. The fact of the matter is that this doesn't bother her. This doesn't bother her. This is nothing to her.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. But yeah, like, overall, this is a little bit, this is unusual, this series. It's done a little bit differently from what you're used to. I guess it could have been shorter, but it took the time to do what it needed to do. It wasn't taking cheesy shortcuts. I was interested, like, there were no like cheap cliffhangers. Like, when you got to the end of an episode, you legitimately wanted to know what happened in the next one. And I would recommend this to listeners. I think it's good. I think it's a little bit more like slow cooked than you're used to in the era of peak TV, but I think there's a place for that. I thought this was well done. Would you agree, Dan?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I enjoyed it. And one more thing that I'll add, the part of the theme of this was the fact that the sheriff was disrespected because she was a woman. That's an important point today in this age. And I'll also say that Kelly was disrespected in terms of being a serial killer because she was a woman.
Yeah.
And she used that.
That's an excellent point.
I mean, she, at least from everything that I saw, I mean, she was, and they did allude to this, she was, she wore the pants.
Yeah.
You know, she was in charge. She was the person who did everything. She's the person who didn't feel anything. And I think that there's sometimes when, I mean, people will readily, and there's certainly enough history of it, but people readily say it, that, you know, a male serial killer, they can believe that, you know, but maybe there are more female serial killers out there than we know, because people give women the benefit of the doubt.
Well, and I think that there's also,
or don't think that they're capable of doing it because they're prejudiced against women.
And I think there's also this idea that a serial killer only operates along this axis of, like, lust murders involving sexual assault and, like, a really bloody end. As we're about to talk about in our cold case section, I think if you expand your definition of means, then a lot more poisonings, Munchausen by proxy cases et al. Come into view. But yes, once again, that is Dead North on Investigation Discovery. That will be available in our show notes. By the time you're hearing this, you should be able to watch it on their website or on the app. And if you are listening, ID Poobahs, I would love to watch Dead South or Dead West or the continuing adventures of the Frizzo-Ogden household in any of their forms. All right, as alluded to, our cold case this week. Is Dark Angel, which involves one of the Victorian era's most prolific poisoners, Marianne Cotton. I think a few listeners or followers on Twitter had recommended that I check this out. I was really looking forward to it. I was a little disappointed. We're going to talk about it, but here's a quick case file. Born on Halloween in the 1830s, Victorian poisoneuse Marianne Cotton is believed to have murdered three of her four husbands, likely to collect on their insurance policies, 11 of her 13 children, and other people, perhaps as many as 21 victims in total. Joanne Froggatt of Downton Abbey stars as Cotton in ITV's two-part 2016 miniseries based on a book by David Wilson, which I would like to read because I feel like it's probably less clonkety-doo-dah than this, which I found quite hard to take. I watched the first episode with Dan, and Dan was like, we should watch another episode to get a better sense of whether it improves. And I said, more for you. I have other things to do. Did things get any better in the second two?
They did. I mean, my big problem with the first episode of three that we saw, my first note was, I'm confused. Because it was
quite people confusing. Dying
left and right. You saw jumps in time. That there was no change in clothing or makeup or hairstyles or anything to designate the passage of time.
One of my notes read, which dead baby is this?
Yeah, I mean, you had babies, like, lordy. Babies just were gone.
Well, and here's the thing about that, though. At that time, I think we begin in the timeline at, like, 1857. And at that time, first of all, it's not unusual for a woman to give birth to 11 or 12 babies and for many of them not to survive. Meet Marianne, she is, I think she's pregnant with she's just had number five and she's lost four.
She's just had number five and she's already pregnant with number six.
Right. Yes. Thank you. So a lot of cuts back and forth to show like they're, you know, these are poor people. Her husband's a minor, so that's a high risk occupation. And there are like cuts back and forth, like sometimes she's pregnant, sometimes she's not. Sometimes she's pregnant standing in a cemetery. It's implied that her stepfather was inappropriate with her. Like there are all these jumps around, and I think that could have been effective to sort of set the scene for the exhaustion that must have attended being a wife with no possibility of birth control. And one of her friends is like, just get him to pull out. But kids, that doesn't work. Go to sex ed. There's a lot of important facts therein. But then instead of like, I think the confusion and sort of wearing down of Marianne could have been effective, but then they would plant their feet and give you all this exposition about how life insurance works, which I really don't feel is necessary to a modern audience. Here's clip 8.
Life insurance. You've done the right thing, lad.
Spending money we haven't got.
Hey, how much am I worth, do you bet? I put a price on me head. Alive or dead, go on.
How much did you have to put in?
The premium is £1.03.04.
Dear God.
It's only once a year.
It's like willing something bad to happen. As if we've not had enough.
No, it's not. It's the opposite. Because if I die, the insurance company pays £35 straight on my widow, no questions asked. Well, I could spend it on beer if you'd rather.
I could have spent that time drinking a beer, but I didn't because I was listening to you explain to me things that I, an adult, already know. That should have been done in half the time. Get to it.
Yeah, I mean, the whole first episode was an attempt, I think, to visualize all this exposition into these incredibly short scenes. Except all the scenes were incredibly short, except the exposition scenes, which dragged on. But to try to encompass this woman's life, and there's just a thousand other ways that are better to do that.
I agree.
I don't think that they needed to do that. And then once you got through all that exposition, when you got into the second hour, and then you ultimately got into the third hour, that did slow down. And you then began to see certain characters who were so brief, you were like, where the fuck did this guy come from? Who is this woman? You know, which kid was that? You began to see them return.
Okay.
And you began to go like, oh, okay. And you began to see how they sort of fit into the woman's life. But the only character who truly had a through line through the entire show was Ms. Cotton. Everybody else was, except for her one main lover, who she ultimately killed off.
Oh, did she?
And his, yeah.
Oh, good, because he was a piece of shit. Fuck him.
He was, yeah, he was not a nice man. But he was perfect for her because she was not a nice woman. He wound throughout the entire series until she ultimately kills him off after being in a situation where she could actually have him.
Let's jump ahead to clip 11, actually, because here's another example of exposition that is much too long, and that this woman, basically her main lover, wants to sleep with her if and when she is married, so that if she does get pregnant, then he's covered, basically. And Marianne, who seems pretty wise in the ways of the world, and spoiler, has already killed off at least, like, I think one baby and one husband by that time, doesn't get this in clip 11.
What is it? Consumption.
Aye. She's been doing so well, you know. Not coughing half so much, but just this week.
And then, Joel, when she's dead...
Shut up. No. Stop it.
We can be together?
Never. Listen to yourself, Marianne. You're wishing a woman who's done no wrong into the next world.
But you don't love her. Or why are you here?
Don't. You're not fit to kiss the ground she walks on.
I don't even know her. You're the one that's betrayed her, not me.
Aye. And I'm the one who'll pay for it. She was never ill before I started this thing with you. It's a punishment. And that is, to be sure, our sins will find us out.
Well, I hope they hurry up about it because you're an asshole.
Yeah. And then the next time you see each other, they run to each other and she immediately whips up her skirt and he just, you know...
Bones her
and, you know, underneath a pier... Then they finish the act, and then they get mad at each other again. I mean, it's a very bizarre, stupid relationship that...
Well, but that she doesn't understand what's going on. And also, there's some anachronistic writing. Like, do you, you know, listen to yourself? Like, I don't feel like that's how people talked. And I don't know. Like, she just seems like... naive, let's say, in ways that don't exactly line up with the character. Here's another example of anachronistic writing. I'm sorry I'm going backwards, but here's clip 10, because I want to leave my favorite clip for last.
It's all right, love.
I was with a man.
You don't have to tell us, love. Don't say anything you'll regret.
I've done things. Terrible things.
Hush now, hush! We all do daft things. But God never sends us more pain than we can stand.
If you really believe that, Dad, you're as cruel as he is.
Oof. I mean, everything about that is like, that's not how people talk. That's not how Victorian ladies talk to their fathers. I don't believe. That's just, if it is, that was bad writing. The music needs to settle down. And this is not Froggatt's fault, but that's terrible acting. And it smells funny.
And your mom is all those things.
Yes, your mom is all those things. I mean, it's really unfortunate because I think that in sort of making this for TV and trying to give us a sense of how one comes to this point, like she has the arsenic to clean. And then her husband, who is gone for weeks and months at a time, and will like come home, knock her up, and then leave her to deal with like five children under the age of four. Comes home and is hurt and can't work, at which time she's like, I'll fix you a cup of tea, stares at the bottle of arsenic for 2 hours, and then starts poisoning him. And it's like, I think that there is a very interesting story here, and I think this acting company was perfectly capable, but they made certain decisions in the first segment that I was like, eh, like I'm turned off and not interested to see what happens because I already know what happens. They hang her. It's a spoiler, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it could have been absolutely fascinating. It could have been absolutely beautiful. I mean, some of the photography is gorgeous. Some of the costuming is gorgeous. They do take great effort to give you a sense of the world.
There is one beautiful shot that I wandered through the living room while you were watching part three, and they realized that they're going to have to dig up pretty much everyone she's ever known who died of like a gastritis.
Once they finally put the arsenic poisoning to it. Yes.
Yeah. But it's this beautiful shot that in which the people and the headstones look very small as they're exhuming various bodies. It's not gruesome. It's just like very heavy and sad and pretty to look at. But I will say this for it. If nothing else, I now have a new ringtone to assign to Dan in my phone. Here is clip 9.
You're an angel. And I'm just a disappointment. I'm sorry.
I'm sorry too, Lou.
You're an angel, lad. Just, I'm sorry. I'm sorry too. Oh, God. Yeah.
First time she made him a cup of tea.
Yeah, and then she invited him to a barbecue at the sailor's house, and
yes.
Everyone lived happily ever after, albeit not for long.
A very short time.
So, listeners, I would love it if you could recommend to us whether we should read the book on which this is based. I tend to find, once I have seen like the American experience based on the Poisoner's Handbook or the book about the shooting of McKinley, that it's like, well, okay, I don't need to go over this ground again. But I did find this frustrating and not there wasn't enough like info. So if the book is good and sort of gives you that same sense of place and time and gives you a peek into how they figured out that it was her and how she was investigated, please let us know once again on Twitter @BlotterPresents. So, Dan, do you regret watching parts 2 and 3?
No, I don't regret it at all. I mean, it did slow up a little bit, you got to see the full story. I mean, here is my one regret. I wish that the people who made the first show that we saw, Dead North, actually made the second show, Dark Angel, because I think they would have been able to find whatever the perfect pace would have been to tell the story. Because they definitely did it with their documentary, and I think that was what was so frustrating to me about Dark Angel, that and the fact that after a while I didn't care anymore who lived or died. I didn't care about the woman. I didn't care about anybody.
Well, and she's just, you know, like, after enough resentful glaring under hair that she has not washed since Lincoln was assassinated, it's like, all right, we got it. Again, not Froggatt's fault. I'm not sure she was directed to show her best, but yeah, this is not for me, I don't think. Yeah, but it's too bad because it seemed like a corker of a story, and I was really expecting quite a bit better. But I do thank you, Dan, for watching the entire thing because
you're an angel.
It's true.
You're my dark angel.
You're an angel, Dan. Do you have anything you would like to plug anywhere that listeners can find you if they need help with real estate or favorite past blotter episodes that you would like them to check out?
If you seriously have any questions about New York City real estate, I'm happy for you to get in touch with me, dan.brady@corcoran.com. In all seriousness, I've been doing it a long time, and I'm quite good at it, and I know New York. I don't know anywhere else in the country, so please do not ask me any other questions. Go to your local realtor and find an honest one, because they are out there. Beyond that, you can keep looking for obscure things that I did that I've now forgotten about if you really have nothing else to do with your life.
I don't. That's another episode of The Blotter Presents. Ladies and gentlemen, coming up in our booking sheet, Berlinger's The Wrong Man on Stars, Evidence of Innocence, Godfather and Son, Smithsonian's Prohibition miniseries, and Last Defense. Got a tip for The Blotter Presents case files? Visit our forums at previously.tv or hit me on social media. That's @BlotterPresents on both Facebook and Twitter. My guest has been Dan Patrick Brady, and you can find him and various rants about Trump, Bigfoot, and tall athletes at Dan Patrick Brady. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I'm on Twitter @TomatoNation. And we will talk to you next time.
This has been a production of the Previously.tv Podcast Network.